Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Material Issues. Can you believe it? This is episode number 56. 56 episodes since we started this. I'm Mark Hirschberger of Pop Detective Records, and joining me, as usual, from the left coast, my good friend from the International Pop Overthrow Festival, Mr. David Bash. How are you this evening, David?
Hey, I just called you Seth. Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah. Ever since I changed my name from Seth to Mark, you've had a hard time with that.
I don't know
why you're doing that, but it's all good.
I guess I'm just anxious to get our guest on. But
everything good in IPO world? I know you're working on the IPO CD.
Yeah, we just got the art files and the music files, and we've just submitted them to our manufacturer. So now it's just having to get the whole thing done. We have almost a month, so I think we'll be okay. You know, there's obviously issues with all kinds of stuff. Hello, whoever this is. It says Facebook user, so I don't know. You can either identify yourself or not, but hello.
You could be using worse things.
Yeah. Episode 56, and of course, anytime I think of, not of course, because most people don't know this, but anytime I think of number 56, I think of Jim Bouton. Definitely one of my, I didn't know him. I met him once, didn't really say anything much, but he had done when I was attending Syracuse University, he did a talk, and it was fun. And afterwards we hung out with him a little bit. But you know, obviously I love Ball Four. I love the kind of how irreverent, iconoclastic, you know, all of that stuff. Did you find the shirt I showed you in London? Oh, is this Barry? Yes, I did. And in fact, I found another one also. Maybe I should go change into that shirt. Not live on air. Well, I can always retreat to the bedroom and do a change. But,
Lord,
that's good. You know what? Screw it. I'm going to do that. Hold on.
It was George Evans. George Evans was...
To quote Tavares, it only takes a minute.
That's what she said. Well, everybody, I'm Mark Hirschberger of Pop Detective Records. I just got some good news in recently. Ace Records out of the UK is going to do a cool girl band rocker compilation CD. They contacted me to have the Dolmans, Bright City Lights, on there. Bright City Lights was off the All Dolled Up CD from a number of years ago. But they've got Blondie, they've even got Vibica Sagastan. They got a lot of great artists, the Donnas, etc., on this big compilation. So it's really cool to have the Dolmans from Pop Detective on there. That'll be coming up probably in a few months, as it's just getting underway right now. But that's kind of what's happening in Pop Detective record land. Outside of that, we've got a great guest coming up tonight. Some of you have already seen it advertised on Facebook. For those of you just checking in, I'm not going to spoil it because here comes David with the shirt. That's David's job to bring it up, but stay tuned. We've got a hot one this evening. So, hey, David, welcome back.
Thanks. Yeah. Barry, this is the shirt. Thank you so much for showing it to me. Barry Gutman came all the way out from Philadelphia to Liverpool, attended several of the IPO shows. Then it found out that he was heading to London, as were Rena and I. And we ended up going to that Len Price 3 show. He told me about it, and Rena and I joined him and went. And when we met outside the venue, he showed me this shirt. And I thought, wow, where'd you get that? And he told me where. It was a place in an area called the Strand in London. And I went. Then went to the shop and picked up this and one other shirt. So thank you, Barry.
Well, thank God he didn't show you his underwear. That's all I can say.
I'm going to leave that alone. I have no snappy retort. Yeah, there you go, Barry. Have a great time.
Nice.
All right. Well, yeah, it's time to bring on our guest. He's the very esteemed singer-songwriter and songwriter extraordinaire. I mean, he co-wrote a huge hit for Taylor Dayne, actually a couple of them. He co-wrote for several, he wrote or co-wrote several hits, records for Al Green and Celine Dion and all kinds of cool stuff like that. And he's been a great artist in his own right, releasing several awesome CDs, both with Mike Rickberg as the Red Button and solo. He's an author on about three baseball books in which he wrote players with questions, asking them to expound upon them. And he printed the letters in these books, and they're great. He did a documentary on the Beatles. He's a jack of all trades and a master of all of them, and a very, very nice guy to boot. Would you please give a huge Material Issues welcome to Seth Swirsky?
There he is.
Hey, thank you so much. That was very nice. So glad to be here.
No, yeah. We're so glad to have you.
Nice to have you here, Seth. As a fan of your, as I wrote, multi-dimensional career, you got a lot that you had going on. You still got it going on. Got a new album out, which we'll talk about as well. But nice to have you here, my friend.
Thank you very much. I really look forward to talking to both of you.
Indeed.
How's the response been so far to the album? I love it, but you know I'm biased because I love all your stuff. But how's the response been?
It's been, you know, fantastic. It's just, you get an email from somebody that you don't know, or you get a response on Facebook, or you get, it's not just, it's very nice to get orders for records, and that's very nice. But after a certain period of time, that's not really the thing that I care too much about. Do you know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. I like to make music that feels good, either buy it or make it myself. It doesn't matter. I just want to hear it. You know,
right.
So yeah. It gives me great joy that people seemingly so far, it came out in mid-April, you know, mid to late April, hasn't been all that long, but I've been getting so much great response from it, from Japan and England and Spain and different radio stations around the world. So I have to say, I'm very pleased, you know, and incredibly honored, you know.
Well,
what do you think? Really pre-pandemic and post-pandemic. We're not really that post-pandemic yet, but we're trying. The difference in releasing an album now as it was, let's say, three, four years ago, in what can be done with it, and you know, people are at home, you know, searching a little bit more. What kind of differences do you see in the world today as far as releasing, you know, a new album such as you have?
Well, you know, you really got to do a lot of legwork yourself, but that was always the case. I think in any of the arts that I've done in my life, whether they go back to the 80s or whatever time, you know, if you don't have your hands in it, then you right. can't really rely, even if you're with the biggest companies in the world, you know, you got to get in there yourself. It's so important, whether it's, you know, writing to a local station or, you know, writing to a DJ that you might have, that might like your music or stuff like that. It's very important to just get involved. Pre-pandemic, post-pandemic, you know, my life didn't really change all that much because I spend a lot of time at home, yeah. You know, and I'm always kind of writing stuff and stuff. Obviously it changed with masks and the things you did and stuff like that and the fear factor and all that. But I just found about it, May or June of 2020, I thought I'm going to put together an album of songs that maybe hadn't been released for years and stuff like that. And I sent a couple over to Fernando Perdomo, and he came back. I said, just give me a drum track for this, or give me a bass track, or put together something for this. And he came back with some good stuff, and they were older things. And that spurred me onto the next level of, wait a minute, I want to write some new things. And then before you know it, your levels keep getting bumped up. I want this record to be better than the last one. You know, things like that. I'm always looking to do something in a record that I haven't accomplished before for myself. Myself. The last record, Circles and Squares, I wanted to play every instrument on it because McCartney did that in 1970 and started him, you know, Ian Emmett Rhodes started that. I was all of 10 years old and thinking, wow, how did they do that? So that was an attempt to accomplish that. I didn't need to do that on this record. So each record kind of has a different goal in mind personally.
But and I was kind of what I was alluding to is just the interactive ability between a lot of people being at home now and a lot of people surfing the internet and listening to Spotify or Bandcamp or whatever it may be. I've just heard from so many people saying, yeah, I've had more time to just find stuff, and I think, that may be a positive when you're talking about, some people pandemically having more time.
Yes.
To,
there's a flip side to that, which is I'm old school. So I would love it if there were still LPs. Obviously, people collect LPs and that's a great thing to have. But I make records for myself. So I wanted to make a CD and make a booklet and all that stuff. Not everybody has to buy the CD. I don't buy many CDs myself. So I'm not really my audience that way. But I wanted to make something that you could hold and touch, right, like I did growing up in my room, that you could see some lyrics or stuff like that. So to circle back to your question, there's a lot of positive about all the access we have now to so much music. It's amazing. But I do miss the physicality of music to hold.
Absolutely. And
hold. We didn't have how many pictures did we have on an LP in 1969? We didn't have that many, but the ones we had were so big and the way we felt when we listened.
Yeah. I can tell in your eyes, that's the way I was. It was just like, you held it up.
Let me interrupt for one second. At the same time we're doing this, and I hate the fact that this is a timing. I'm in the middle also of trying to send files for the IPO CD, which you are on. Thank you very much. I am trying to send the files to my manufacturer. So if I seem a little bit distracted, that's why. But let me ask you this before I get back to that. Did you record this record at home, or do you have a studio nearby?
I don't have any equipment at home. As a matter of fact, I own one guitar. I have one piano. I am incredibly old school when it comes to that stuff. I'll tell you why. A lot of people have home recording studios, and I think that's fantastic. Great, great thing to have. And the sounds you can get from that today are unbelievable. Maybe you can't even tell the difference, all of that. But, I can't stand it when first of all, I like to write songs in the old-fashioned way, sitting on a couch, cross-legged with an acoustic guitar. I still have an old cassette tape thing that I hit play and record, to scroll up and down. I like it the old way. I'm used to it, and I don't want to veer from that. But the main reason I go to a studio to record every album is if I have an inspiration, if I hear like, oh, I got to put keyboards on this thing right now, or I hear what that electric guitar part is. When you have a home studio and you put the headphones on ready to record that and you hear buzz in your left ear and you think, now I got to get underneath the thing and plug that in and do this half an hour and it kills the feeling. So yeah. I would rather pay for a studio. I would rather pay an engineer to be an engineer. I like to call the shots from when I hear it. And that's just the way I go about doing it. I just like to separate it out into what I do best and be able to immediately hit the art notes at the moment I feel them.
No, and that's great. I wish every artist had the opportunity to do that, but I'm really glad you do.
Yes.
It does make for a better record. And as you mentioned, when you have momentum going,
yes,
the last thing you want is equipment issues. The last thing you want is anything to interrupt you.
That's right. Nothing to interrupt. And as a matter of fact, it's funny.
Mark was thinking that's what she said. But no,
I wasn't. I'm not going there. No.
I went there. That's
when I'm in the middle of a piano track or something, and then I hear something, I like to say to the engineer, no, I meant this here and I meant this here. Let's figure out how we get to whatever, because I want to play. Because I'm feeling it, and I think feeling in a record is kind of half the song.
Right. Yeah. Well, getting back to just music in general, we like to circle back to the beginning, and we ask our guests, where did it all start for Seth Swirsky? At what age did you have parents that were into music? Older brothers? How did music come into your life?
My parents had me at 18. They were both 18. They were freshmen in college. Mm-hmm. And the big songs that were on at that time, the number one record on at that time, which I remember like it was yesterday, was Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Oh, okay.
So I started with Peter, Paul, and Mary and Ray Charles at the same time. My parents were very young, so they listened to those records. And all throughout my upbringing, my mother would buy the Mamas and the Papas, and she would play it till 2-3 in the morning. And I'd be up in my bedroom listening. You know, I mean, there was so much music happening that it just became a part of me. I always wanted to do what I'm doing.
Were they musical? Did they play? Did they teach you? Or did you kind of come through it organically yourself?
We had a Giannini guitar in my house, and my mother played a lot of folk songs. Okay. And then, but you know, having three kids, and she was also a nurse and a whole bunch of different things, she veered away from that. And she's a painter as well. She's still a painter. But when I heard her play the guitar, I had to take lessons. And before I knew it, I had, you know, 6 or 7 teachers that I just wore out. I mean, I really needed to play. I wanted to, but I needed to. It was one of those things that you know are in you that you just have to do.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And early on, at what stage were you thinking that you could write some things? What was some of your earliest memories of actually putting words down on paper and trying to match the music to it or vice versa?
Well, when I was 15, I went to Sound Tech Studio in Manhattan to record 4 songs that he ended up putting on a acetate. I didn't know what an acetate was. Everybody in my high school thought I made an album. So I was such a rock star for the moment. People were lending out my album, right?
Singular, my album.
Singular, exactly, exactly. But that's when I first had a chance to write and record something and get the feel for it. I think it was when in my junior year of college, I had a jingle that I wrote for Thomas's English Muffins hit the airwaves.
Oh, and wow.
You usually go into the first thing you make money doing, you know, when you're that age, because, you know, direction is such a big thing at that age. But I remember I was about to have a meeting about another thing to write a jingle for. And I remember thinking, do I want to write for peanut butter the rest of my life? It was a real moment. And it wasn't, that's not a knock on jingle writers. It's an amazing.
You didn't want to be Charlie Harper.
I think that's right. And that was a real moment that you can, you know, pinpoint a certain thing to. And I said, no, I want to write the 2 to 3 minute pop song that I grew up with. I wanted to, you know, write Beatles songs. You know, that was my bar without knowing that exact phrase.
Right. So
that's when
you must have been a big Beach Boys fan also. I mean, it's all over your music.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, I was a very big Beach Boys fan, but not nearly as much. They weren't as East Coast as Beatles. I grew up listening to WNEW FM, so we got all that British stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, you and me both, Seth. I mean, we're only a couple of years apart. So.
Yeah.
You know, Scott Muni, Vince Scalzo.
When those guys started playing some of my music over the last 10 years or whatever, I couldn't believe when I looked at the list that Vince Scalzo added one of my. Are you kidding?
My God.
The Moody Blues. And, you know, it was.
That's big great. Stuff,
you know?
Yeah, that's big time. So you, when you got out of high school, did you go on to college?
I did.
And what was your idea at that time? What were you looking at with college, and how did music completely screw that up?
Okay, well, when I was applying for college, I was obviously 17 years old. I was a senior in high school applying for colleges. And I will never forget, I was thinking when I was in the guidance counselor's office, and they were telling me the schools that they thought were good for me and this and that. I remember thinking, in 2 years, I'm going to be 19. And that's when George Harrison made it. So I don't want to go to college.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, I was going to go to college. I grew up in that kind of family, in that kind of community. Of course I was going to go. But everything was kind of based on, well, George was 19. So I can maybe get in a year and then whatever. But what I decided to do was I wrote a lot when I was in college. And my first big break of when I knew that I could do this thing was I pitched a song to Chapel Music. It's now Warner Chapel.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And to a senior vice president up there. And he put on the cassette and he gave it 10 seconds and zoomed it back, and then 15 seconds and zoomed it back, and 30 seconds. And I'm thinking, what does this mean? Does he like it? Does he not like it? What's going on? He offered me a contract right away for that song. And he said, listen, Barbra Streisand's looking for a song right now. One song, a single.
Wow.
And I think this is a single, and we're going to send you the contract. And I'm thinking, I can't really believe what I'm hearing, mm-hmm. because I was still on that track of making it by 19, you know? And I ended up going to classes, but we didn't have cell phones. So I'm like, did I get any messages? You know, I'm like waiting for a call from the senior vice president of Chapel Music to tell me whether Barbra Streisand is putting out my song.
And you're at Dartmouth, right? So you're at a serious school. You must have been a great student in high school to get
into. Oh, well, as good as I could be.
Good enough, really, against Ivy League. But anyway, go ahead.
No, I had the end of the story is I got a phone call from that guy, and I'm like, my hand is shaking. I'm thinking, this is the moment. And he said, listen, you didn't get it. You lost to this guy named Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Hack.
And, you know, I think the name of his song was Coming In and Out of Your Life. That was the song in 1981. Okay. But, you know, I'm really a half glass full person. I really, at the time, I thought to myself, you know what? I think I can play in this league. You know, because when you're writing and you're in your teens and your early 20s, you're like, can I do this thing? It's very overwhelming because, you know, you grow up with these artists and you think there's no way I could ever write with these people or be in that league. But once you get a little, that was a good moment. I didn't really need to get that to go my, you know, to go my way. And that's the thing about the music business, especially as a songwriter, you got to know there's going to be lots of hits and misses. You're lucky if it's like a baseball player. You make the Hall of Fame if you fail seven times.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
So not
with today's stats. If you hit 300, but your on base percentage is 320, you're not getting in the hall anymore.
Exactly.
But it's interesting though. Just to the point of how you knew at that point when you're writing material, you're writing stuff. How did you know that I've got to take this somewhere? I've got to go to, you know, Chapel Warner and present this to somebody. I mean, we've interviewed a lot of artists from the 60s into the 70s and how they walked in to a major label with their tape, handed it to the guy, and the guy said, "Oh, you're signed." And they're like, it happened just like that. And we're like, holy cow, things like that don't happen today anymore because everything's different. But how did you know? I mean, how did you know what to do or attempt to do?
I mean, did you have demos at the time that you were shopping around?
I did. I had songs here and there. That one song was for the Streisand thing, but it wasn't even meant for her. It just, I demoed it with a friend, and she's a terrific singer, and it just happened to flow. It's a very Streisand-like song, and I just wrote at the time. I had no feeling about, I want to be a songwriter. You know, I didn't know what I wanted to be. I just wanted to be a quote-unquote, like, in the Beatles world, in a way. Like, whatever that meant. You know, it wasn't like, I need to change the music business. I need to write the greatest things ever. I didn't quite know what it meant. And, you know, as you go along, you realize, what am I good at and what am I not good at? And then the path starts to form itself, you know? So, you know, it was just a matter of, I wasn't writing a tremendous amount, but I was writing and really trying to concentrate on my songs. I got a job at Chapel Music after that thing with Streisand, that nice man. I said, listen, can I at least work there? I'm right out of college. And one day everybody left the office and I'm looking at a Rolodex. You remember those? And it was open. The Rolodex was open and there was the name Eric Carmen.
Mm-hmm.
And it had his address and phone number. So I said, okay, this is how you do it. You got to go for it. And I start dialing and Eric picks up the phone. And I'm 21 years old and I told him my story. And he said, you know, you sound like a really nice guy and you know my song so well, you know, because his last record had just come out on Arista and didn't do all that well, but I love the songs on it. Sleep With Me and
oh, yeah. Great stuff. Yeah.
Great stuff. So I'm telling him about that, and he was impressed that I knew that. He goes, hey, come out to Cleveland. I got on a plane. I went to Cleveland, and he taught me a number of things about songwriting that I learned from Eric Carmen. I mean, like, he basically said about himself, he said, I can't write a bad song at this point. he said, that's not an ego thing. I'm not saying that every song I write's a hit or it's great or anything, but I've learned how to write a song over all the years that I know it's going to be a decent song. That gave me a lot of confidence. Mm-hmm. And he said, listen, Pete Townsend taught me one day, and I'm thinking, I'm sitting here and he's talking about his conversation with Pete Townsend. Okay. And there are all his gold records are on the wall. He's living in an apartment, you know. And he said, Pete Townsend told me one day, he goes, listen, it all starts with the title. The title starts the song before a chord is played, a single note is played. It's the title. That doesn't mean you have to have the title first, but it's so important. So it was these little things along the way that also helped kind of, it was like getting a master's degree in songwriting from, you know, one of the best.
Well, let's go ahead, Dave.
One of the things you know, you said to yourself, this is something I want to do. I think I can do it. The thing about songwriting is any individual may very well have the talent to do it. It's not like you haven't graduated high school, you don't plan to, and you say, I'm going to be an aerospace engineer. I'm not going to graduate high school. I'm not going to get a degree in physics. I'm not going to do anything, but I'm going to be an aerospace. It's like, no, you're not.
Yeah, right.
But yeah. If you say you want to be a songwriter, all you need to do is have the talent and the initiative, and you can be it, and you can do it. And
Great. Look at Patti Smith. You know, she was a poet. She didn't think of herself as a songwriter. And all of a sudden, a band gets together, Lenny Kaye and these guys. And I just went crazy when I heard that Patti Smith, those records, especially that first one, Horses. Yeah. But she didn't start out being a songwriter. She was a poet. So right. Like you say, you know, but they turned into great songs.
And your process, you know, mentioning Townsend saying it starts with a title, as you said, you don't have to start with the title, but that's the main thing. What is your process? Do you think lyrics first, or are you humming melodies first, or is it a combination of both, or what streams into your head that comes out Seth music?
Well, mostly for me, it's I sit down at a piano or guitar. I'm really a guitar player who plays a lot of piano. I write on both, and I never quite know the mood I'm in. So I allow it to come through me, through my arms and my fingers. So a minor chord might start to happen, whatever. And it has to be a melody that I'm starting to sing and play and form as I'm going. And I sing fake words to them. Tell It to My Heart is a good example. I had da 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 da, and I just started singing fake words to it. And then I knew they couldn't be the words, but then before you know it, you keep going with it. You know you like it enough that it goes to what I call the second level, which is, this is really, I can't get this out of my head. It's better than, you know, 10 other things, whatever. And then when I get to the second level, I cannot go back because I think I'm cheating myself if I go back. So I mostly start with music, because to me the music and the mood dictate what the lyrics are going to be.
Right.
I kind of see. I think lyrics. I know I'm going to get hammered for this. I promise. I promise I am. I think lyrics. I think of them a little bit as a secondary thing. That doesn't mean they're not important or we don't love them. Elton John started with Bernie Taupin's paintings, basically. They weren't just lyrics. They were Monets, you know. But that's a little rare. You know, yes. I see it as the music is kind of the furniture in a room and the lyrics are the drapes.
I totally get that. And in fact, I wanted, I mean, this brings up something I've been saying all. I mean, I'm no songwriter, but you think about McCartney, some of his lyrics when he was a Beatle and when he was doing, especially in his early solo career. You think about a lot of pop songs. The lyrics, it's more important that the lyrics sound good that they mean something. The lyrics are part of the whole landscape of the sound. If you're Bob Dylan, yeah, you want them to mean something. I get that. Yes. But if you're Paul McCartney, you know, let's all get up and sit, you know, dance to a song. Your mother should know. I mean, what the hell was that? What was Hello Goodbye? You know, yes. Isn't that
nothing? It's more important.
They sounded great.
That's right. It's more important that lyrics aren't bad than if they're good.
Well, yeah, you don't want them to be awful, but yeah, I know what you mean.
Right. It's more important that they aren't bad. And in my process as a young songwriter, you know, to get through when I was writing songs and still learning, I was a little too literate. I was like, well, I can't say it this way because there's a comma here and, you know, it's better if I say it that way. And then I would sing it and it just didn't sound right. It's so important to just sing and play and feel. Are you feeling good when you're writing? Does it feel good? Don't be so literate. Now, at the same time, Paul Simon, unbelievable lyrics. Billy Joel, amazing, amazing. These guys are amazing. But they start with the music.
Yeah,
no doubt. Yeah,
But then again, you know, I mean, Tell It to Your Heart, you know, works out really well. But it probably wouldn't have worked out so well if it was Tell It to Your Uncle.
How did you know that's what it originally was?
How did you get?
I found that. I found the acetate.
Did you know Taylor Dayne? Because you grew up in Long Island, as did she. Did you know her, or was that just a break?
It was a complete break. We recorded the song. The girl who sang Like a Rose also sang the demo for Tell It to My Heart. I wasn't sure if I liked it. And when I got the demo and I went home, you know, you have to deliver 12 songs a year. So if you write a half a song, that's a half a song of the 12, right? I wrote most of my songs on my own. So it's still a lot, believe it or not, 12 is a lot. Because each one, you're trying to write a hit, you know, so sure. It's got to have a certain thing. And I'll never forget thinking to myself, you know what? I'm not even going to deliver this song. I don't know if it's good enough. And then at the last second, I thought, you know, deliver everything. Just put in what you do. And somebody at the company that wasn't even a song plugger, there was somebody that did charts and whatever. They had heard it coming out of somebody's office. Wow. She knew of somebody that knew somebody of a girl who was singing in a Russian club in Brooklyn who wanted to get a song to try to get a record deal. And before you knew it, I was on vacation in San Francisco. I rent a car and I'm there with my girlfriend. I turn on the radio and I hear my song coming out of the radio.
Oh my God.
The first time I'd ever heard a song of mine on the radio.
Oh, that thing you do moment, huh?
Yeah.
A tremendous, beyond great feeling. It never gets old.
No. But I mean, you know, I tell my daughters all the time, you keep throwing darts. You don't know when the bullseye might land, you know, so keep doing it. But yeah. I mean, that's a perfect example of just, you know, all the kismet, everything coming together just exactly right at the right time.
The closest moment I ever had to that, Seth, was when I was watching the movie, The Mayor of the Sunset Strip.
Oh, yes.
And there's a moment where they're showing Rodney's console, either Rodney or Chris Carter's console. I forget. And for a second and a half, you see the second IPO CD.
Oh.
And it's like,
oh, wow.
Oh, I'm probably the only one in the theater who noticed that. But it was like, that's the closest I'll ever get to one of your moments.
Hey, you never know, David. Keep throwing darts, buddy. You know, you never know.
To hear my songs, but yeah.
it's good. Outside of after that moment, what year was Tell It to Your Heart?
87.
All right. 87.
All of 87, but it went into 88 and it was on the charts for 26 weeks. And then wow. I wrote her next song called Prove Your Love, which continued this whole thing. And sometimes people refer to it as like, you know, I thought you were like, you wrote that kind of melodic, you know, 60s, 70s type stuff. How did you write those dance songs? And, you know, it's interesting. I always feel like I have to correct that a little bit. Tell It to My Heart's a pop song. It's mm-hmm. a pop song. You know, to me, pop music makes you sing. You know what I'm saying? Makes you dance a little bit, whatever. Of course, it was done in that style where it hit the clubs and all that. But to me, it was a pop record.
And it sticks in your head.
You could have made that song into a power pop. You know, if the Knack did that song or the Raspberries did, it would have been a total power pop song. Yeah. Arrangements obviously changed the genre. But yeah, it's a pop song, no doubt.
Yeah, indeed. DC Toontime said he had a greeting card he designed for Hallmark show up in a soap opera.
Well,
that's
go.
His moment. Yeah,
so that's more like my moment than Seth. Seth is way better.
So this starts the ball rolling, and you start writing for a lot of people. Anything interesting story wise as far as the Al Green's? Oh my God, everybody you got on here.
Did you meet Rufus Al
Wainwright,
Green?
Air Supply? You got all kinds.
Did
of
you get
stuff.
A chance to hang out with some of these people, especially Al Green? I need to know that.
Oh, you know, everybody that I ended up writing for was not that far removed in the time that they did one of my songs from me sitting in my green chair. Of course, the name of my new album is Songs from the Green Couch. There's something about green and music with me. I don't know what it is. And then there's Al Green right in the middle of it all. But, you know, I wasn't very far removed from having my headphones on and listening to these artists. So everything was a surprise to me and a thrill. It was like, oh, Michael McDonald is doing my song. Didn't he just do Minute by Minute? I just bought that record, you know, or stuff like that. And the beauty of being a songwriter is that you can write for a whole panoply of different artists. It's not like I got to be very good friends with the guy who was the lead singer of The Fix.
And
I was Cy Kernan.
Cy, yeah.
We got into a conversation. We started writing a song together. And I said, Cy, what it must be like to play these festivals, 50,000 people. And he said, what it must be like to write for Smokey Robinson or the Spinners. I'm not allowed to write that stuff. I got to write for my band. So that was such a nice, you know, back and forth with him in terms of experiences. I really enjoyed, I wrote a song for Smokey Robinson. I met him backstage at Westbury. It turns out I've met him a few times. I got to give him an award at the HMMAs a couple of years ago. You know, Smokey. I mean, all the Beatles love Smokey Robinson. And I have this connection with him where he did a work of mine. Or I'll tell you one very quick story of a failure it really points out that... you know, it's just about hanging in there and you've got to accept the good and the bad. Al Green had done Love is a Beautiful Thing and amazing, got a platinum record for it. And, you know, it was wonderful. Al Green, wow. And Celine Dion had done one of my songs right around the same time, mid-90s, something like that, on her second record. Now she was really selling records, double platinum, all that. And I'm thrilled, you know. And then she came out with her third record. She was looking for a song for her third record. They asked me to pitch a song. So I said, you know what? That song that Al Green did, Love is a Beautiful Thing, I think that would be a great song for her. And she flipped for it. She went crazy. She loved it. And I wrote the song myself. Okay. So I knew it was going to be on a big record. Everybody was writing for her now, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And all of a sudden, I don't know where I was. I think I was in Massachusetts somewhere. And I get a phone call and they said, you know, Celine was in the middle of recording your song. It was going to be one of the top two singles. And she stopped recording it because she found out Princess Diana died and that was her best friend. So she thinks the karma is really bad.
Oh, man.
32 million albums later.
Okay. You can't
call that a failure.
No, failure.
It's not like she came back and said, Seth, I don't really like your song. That was
right. No, that's true. That's true.
That's just an unhappy accident.
An unhappy accident. But the crazy turnaround on the story was a few months go by and I wasn't upset by it at all. You know, I mean, obviously the news was a lot worse than getting on a record or not. But it was just it was a confluence of things that was a disappointment. And then the New York Times, I'm looking at the New York Times, I'm opening it up, and there's a huge ad for a Christmas album called the Princess Diana Tribute Album, what everybody was on. You know, everybody wrote a song for that, the Bee Gees and McCartney, and that was Candle in the Wind with Elton, and, you know.
Right.
And it turns out that Tina Turner recorded Love is a Beautiful Thing, the same song that Celine didn't do. So wow. It all comes around.
Now, and you've written for so many varied artists.
I better investigate this noise here.
No. Well, you've written for a lot of different artists and genres. Did it ever, because you're a songwriter, did it ever start to feel like a job, or did every single time you heard that this person recorded this, was it like the first time? I mean, what's the feeling? What's the feeling there?
It's a great question. There were moments I didn't love being a songwriter because there was an artist in me. Mm-hmm. And you're limited as a songwriter to write for that particular artist.
Right.
So I really needed to have the career as a songwriter first. And then I started as a solo recording artist in the early 2000s when I just had nothing left in me to write for other people, you know?
Yeah, because, you know, if you write one or two things for some other people, and that was huge, then you go on to be your solo artist or within a group situation. But you had so much going on for, you know, a lengthy period of time that I was just wondering whether you felt like, you know, you were in one of the offices in the Brill Building with a piano, and you're just like, oh, here's another day. I got to come up with just a bunch of
stuff. It wasn't quite that. But I was kind of a 50-50 guy that hadn't, I like writing for other people. Mm-hmm. And I was thrilled when I made a record or something, when it got on a record. But there was that 50% piece that I wasn't kind of allowing myself to explore as an artist.
Right, right.
The way it spilled out for me was I had my career as a songwriter for others. And then it naturally turned into wanting to make my own records.
And the success that you had with some of those songs, obviously there's a financial gain with that. That allowed you some comfortability to be able to branch out and do some other things that you wanted to do without having to worry about how I'm going to, you know, buy the groceries, so to speak. Which I think is it's a good stepping stone, because you earned the right to be a little more comfortable doing some other things. You know?
Yes, and I would
not only musically, but you know, writing, your authorship, and
I always wanted to make my own projects before I pitched them to companies. Mm-hmm. So when I did my baseball books, before I pitched them to Crown or Times Books or stuff like that, I lived with it for such a long time, so I could figure out the problems in it and what an editor would say. I really didn't want editors taking apart things. Or when I did my Beatles movie, Beatles Stories, I made that myself, you know, with my money, because I wanted to then pitch it. I didn't want people saying, well, you can't do that, or you can't do that, or you can't do that. I would rather lose, you know, or have nobody see it, but I need to make it. I like creative freedom as much as I can.
What the fuck? Right. Now, were you...
My house must be burned.
Is that yours, David? Is that your house?
Yeah, David's house is... something's wrong with his house.
How do we know it's his house?
I have no idea. Now, you grew up what? A Yankees fan or a Mets fan?
I sound like a fair weather fan, but I'm actually... I was a big Mets fan in the 60s.
Okay. All right.
In the early 70s, I still am hurting over the fact that they lost a 73 series, the Mets, to Oakland, when they were up 3-2.
Well, you know, though, Seth, you have to say they lucked into getting into that series. It's, that year.
You know,
82, that's 82 wins, you know.
Yes. So right. But they seem to still have the magic, you know.
And Doug McGraw saying, you got to believe. It carried them to the series. So
that's right.
There's obviously something there. But I was actually a fan of the Mets.
In the second,
I was a fan of the Mets until they won in 69. And then a couple of my friends who were Yankee fans convinced me to convert. And I've been a Yankees fan ever since.
I love the Yankees of the mid to late 70s. And I love the Mets in that early period too. It wasn't whoever's winning. I just like the characters of those teams. And I understand people who don't like George Steinbrenner, or people who think the Mets just lucked in 69 as well, whatever. I just happen to love those teams. I didn't love the 86 Mets. They were too coked up, and they were just, that period of time was a little bit harder to really love a team that was so, I don't know. Whatever. I like
filled with idiots like Len Dykstra. Oh.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So, what was a bigger thrill, though? getting Songwriter of the Week with American Music Magazine or singing the national anthem at Wrigley Field?
Oh, maybe the question should be, what was the most nerve-wracking?
Now, I obviously know the answer to that, but
those were both absolute major thrills. When I was asked to do the national anthem from the Cubs had contacted me and they said, we're big fans. Will you sing the national anthem? Somehow it computed to me that what they were talking about was take me out to the ballgame, of course, the whole stadium. Is like, I really didn't think of what it really took, A. And B, I just like taking on challenges. Mm-hmm. If something is new to do, even though I'm not comfortable with it, I don't like the fact that I cast it aside. I want to take the challenge. So I brought my nine-year-old. All of a sudden, they say, you know, please pay your attention to third base, base, base. A member of the red button. And it's like up on the
really?
Board. Wow. Oh, my God. And I blanked on the lyrics. That's not what happened. I blanked at the moment. And I just finally got those first words. And the thing that got me into it, and it's on YouTube.
Okay.
The thing that got me into it and made it sound good or made it happen was the reverb off of the fans felt so comfortable to me. I felt like I was in a studio at that moment.
Oh, wow.
I actually felt like I'm digging this. And when mm-hmm. you're digging something, you're comfortable with it, it flows. And I never tried to hit any big notes. I wasn't going to do any more Mariah Carey stuff. But once it was finished, and it was a very simple rendering, but when we went to our seats afterwards, so many people patted me on the back and they said, that's the way it should be sung. Now, let me tell you something. I'm not a national anthem singer, you know, like that. But I think that they appreciated how I did it. And really, to be honest with you, it was because I was limited. You know, mm-hmm. I really couldn't do a whole big thing. But I'm kind of glad. I was never going to do a Jose Feliciano thing.
Was it difficult, though, standing there? I always wonder, what do you hear? Is there slapback and reverb to mess you up?
It didn't mess me up because I'm so used to it. Okay. I sometimes say to an engineer, you know, give me that slapback, like Lennon would say, you know, put some mustard on it. I felt like they were doing that. And what was weird was I'm standing at third base. I'm looking into the Atlanta Braves dugout. They were playing that night. And I'm looking at Chipper Jones and I'm thinking, he probably thinks I'm like somebody. He's Chipper Jones. You know? So many things run through your head. And then you think, get back, center and get those first words. You know?
I want to get back to your books. I was distracted. I heard Mark bring them up. I don't know how much you covered, but obviously all the letters. You did something that a lot of people wish they did, but always figured, I don't have the time or they're not going to answer me. And you sent out letters to ball players asking them one specific question, and you got some great answers from a lot of them. Who was the biggest thrill? Was it double duty Radcliffe? Didn't you get something from him?
Oh my God, yes. There are so many. I love the one where Gates Brown, the Tigers slugger from the 1968 season in the World Series and everything. He just told a story of when he was in the dugout. He's usually called on to pinch hit, you know, by at least the seventh inning. And he figured that he wasn't being called on. So he got a hot dog. And, you know, Mayo Smith, the manager, says, get out there. You're pinch hitting right now. He takes the hot dog. He stuffs it into his uniform. He gets a double. And he's rounding first. He slides at the second. There's hot dog and mustard all over. I mean, every day I go to my mailbox, there'd be 10 or 12 letters. It was Christmas every day because I knew players. I had a big baseball collection at the time. It all kind of flowed. And I love stories, but when you see them in someone's handwriting, it makes it personal. You know, it shows their personality and who they are. I put it together in just a loose leaf book, like you would in grade school, and then I started pitching it to different companies. And before you knew it, I was like doing the morning shows. I'd never done that before. So I really do believe in any project I would say anything in life, but mostly in creative projects, passion for what you're doing it's more than money. Mm-hmm. You know, I did my Beatles movie with a handheld camera, and I had a second camera that I usually propped up, you know, on somebody's book. I was at Henry Winkler's house. I said, can I use that book to prop this? I mean, it was so, it was so like not with a crew and a whole thing, but it's passion. You can do anything you want if you have it, if you really believe, because a project is usually not short and you've got to get through that long stretch. It's easy to get excited at the beginning or when you see the end and you know good stuff's going to happen. Maybe you get a review or, you know, you see the end product. It's that long stretch, and only when you have a lot of passion can you get through that.
As sort of a tangential story, you had a huge memorabilia collection at once. Yeah. Maybe the most famous item you had was the Bill Buckner ball. Yeah. How did you get that? Did you win it in an auction or somebody knew?
Well, that ball went through. When it went through Buckner's legs, it was picked up in the outfield by the linesman, you know, the ref and down the right field line. The umpire, right. He picked it up and he gave it to the Mets traveling secretary. And at that time, yeah, there were people collecting, but it wasn't so crazy as it is now, where everything is, you know, the shoelaces of, you know, Phil Rizzuto, you know, you know, that kind of thing. It had something like they thought it would go for like $5,000 or something. And there was an auction, and Charlie Sheen bought it for, you know, $90,000, some crazy amount. So it really put a lot of the collecting world on the map.
Right. Yeah.
Years go by, and I was collecting team signed baseballs. I love that I could be holding in my hands the 1935 New York Giants, for instance, or the 1955 Brooklyn Dodgers, and they're all their names. They all held this ball and they all wrote their names. But I decided I wanted to branch out into some other things. There was an auction, and at this auction, Charlie Sheen decided to put that baseball up because there was a break-in at the All-Star Cafe in New York. This ball wasn't there, but he said, the hell with it. So I'm going to put everything up. In the same auction was Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point ball. The
Wow.
Everybody was looking that way.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, wait a minute, why are there very few bids on this ball? This is the Kennedy assassination moment of all times when it comes to baseball. I mean, everybody knows where they kind of were. And the Red Sox haven't won it in so many years. It's so many stories. It's the curse. Mm-hmm. It's so many big stories. So I won the ball for it about half the price. And I remember when my wife came back from a business trip, I said, listen, I've got to break this to you. I've got to tell you, I spent this money on this ball. She goes, great. I trust you. I think I believe it. It's great. And it turns out that ball just in 2012, I sold my entire collection.
Yeah.
And nobody knew who bought the ball. And it just turns out that over this last half year, we find out that it was bought by the new owner of the New York Mets, who happened to grow up in Great Neck, like me. And we're similar ages. The only thing, if I can't say so myself, is in every interview he does, I seem to get X'd out of the story, even though I'm But somehow, I'm not as big as Charlie Sheen.
Do you regret having sold your... And I ask you this because... I had, this is no brag. This is a fact. I had one of the 10 best collections of minor league baseball cards in the world. And in 1993, I needed money, and I had to sell off the whole collection.
Yes.
I don't know if that was your motivation, but unfortunately, it was mine. And I really wish I still had it. Do you wish you still had the memorabilia collection?
I'm going to answer you very honestly. I really don't. I don't. My ex-wife and I had just separated. That's always a difficult time. And I definitely wanted to show it's not about the money. It's not about the stuff. You know, I felt very honored to have owned it. This stuff. For what, almost 20 years. So I felt like I was a good caretaker of these things. What I did keep, David, that I'm very, very proud of, is I have all the letters in my books you know, letters from Paul McCartney and a few presidents while they were president, you know, talking about, so George W. Bush, like him or not, wrote a fantastic letter about how, you know, when he was a catcher growing up and how he wanted to please his father, the other president, the other Bush president. So there's so many great letters. I made that history. So I'm very happy about that. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of what I call history balls, where I would take a ball that was, let's say, Bobby Thompson's big home run in 1951. And I'd get Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca to sign it. That's not such a big deal. A lot of people have that ball. But I had each panel, I had a lot of the other players that did big things on that play write their whole story. I was playing left field and I thought I had a beat on the ball. So I have all of these, I have about, I don't know, 100, 150 of these balls with all the major events going back to the 20s and 30s of players that were still alive when I was doing this, having written what they did on the side of the ball.
That's cool.
That is very cool.
And do you, I mean, do you still collect anything new these days? You know, David and I always talk about the psychology of collecting and why we do it. And yeah, as you can see behind him,
the book I want to write, the psychology of collecting.
And, oh, yeah. What do you seek out anymore? Or is that just something that you don't really think too much about anyway, as far as?
Well, back in, I don't know when it was, but I had this thought that Lyndon Johnson in 1968 got on TV, I think it was March 24th, 1968, got on TV and said, I won't be running for the presidency. That was a major moment in modern American history, certainly. Sure. So I thought, okay, well, Bobby Kennedy was murdered on June 5th. He died June 6th, but there has to be a limited amount of Bobby Kennedy pins. So I figured, you know, that was a major event in my life. I was in second grade. I felt very deeply about it back then. And I like to do things that I still feel I can reach into the past and still get a feeling from. So I started to collect Bobby Kennedy pins. And I had 8 of them and then 10 of them. I said, how many could there be? Well, I now have all 234
Holy
of them.
Holy crap.
It's wow. The whole thing, and I call the piece Bobby Pins.
Nice. Nice. I like it.
Oh, you're talking about passion. Obviously, politics is something of which you're very passionate.
Yes.
Your views are, you know, as we know on Facebook, are obviously polar opposites to a lot of you know, your fans. Yeah. Has that become an issue? Have people decided they don't want to listen to your records? They're not going to buy your music because they don't agree with your politics?
If somebody decides that they don't want to listen to my music because of my politics, I respect that. I really do. I respect that. I can't tell somebody how to feel that way. I don't agree with Barbara Streisand, but I love hearing her sing. That's just me. But I don't denigrate anybody that feels that way. I really don't. I have to be honest. There are some people when I put out this new album that I have out now, some people have not reviewed it, and they've been long time reviewers of my solo records and Red Button records. Now, maybe they just didn't like it, but that's not how it feels, because they would, I don't expect a great review from people. You know, you could review it feels the way they do about it. But there have been a few of those, I have to say. And
I know one of them.
Yeah.
We won't mention any names.
Okay.
Here we go. Will there ever be another Red? And that's another good question, because obviously you're not working with Mike at present.
Yes.
Is that something that can be rectified, do you think?
I would never say no to it. I think the best singer, songwriter, producer out there is Mike. I really do. I think he's a tremendous, you know, and you know what I say? I've been in the trenches with him. Okay, so it's a little different than just hearing what he does and how he does it. I've been in the, you know, really in the room, you know, and he's a tremendous, tremendous talent. And I love him as a person. So I would never say no, of course not.
I certainly hope it can. I mean, not that your solo stuff is wonderful. Yeah. The Red Button stuff is wonderful. But obviously the Red Button stuff, it adds a different, you know, adds another dimension to the music. Yes. So having both has just been great.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you.
And of course, how we bring this all to the present is your latest album released in April, Songs from the Green Couch. To me, just more slices of Beatle-ish psychedelia pop. Sunny Days is my favorite off the off the album. Really well done.
I really
done.
Love Rose Avenue, but you know
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
That's the next single. That's the next single. Nice. We Yay. Just shot the video yesterday. Yeah.
Well, excellent. And that I wanted to put that up right here. That can be found www.realseth.com. That's all information on Seth Swirsky and his new album and where you can find it. So if you really like that good, well, I call it Beatlesque pop. It's Seth Swirsky pop, but you know,
lots of Beach Boys-isms too.
Beach Boys, yeah, okay. a lot of things going on. I highly recommend you check it out.
I hear that.
Gary said the great new album and Green Couch is cool too.
Yeah, no doubt.
Thank you. Thank you.
A lot of things going on, but yeah, we wish you the best with that.
Thank you.
Glad you put that out. And I've been listening to it pretty hardcore the last week or so since David's ever going to join us on here. So really well done. Really well done.
What do you think is next for you? Not just musically, but in any realm.
Yeah. In any realm. Well, I just wrote my fifth book, and it's a children's book. The one I did before was 21 Ways to a Happier Depression, because I got
my wanted to ask you about that.
Probably, so they're mostly tips for when you're feeling and in the preface I say this is not a way of curing depression. These are kind of tips along the way that have helped me kind of distract me and do other things that you can, it can be lesser than it was, you know. And then I did a children's book this year called Shh, Your Toes Are Sleeping, which is a way of helping children get to sleep at night. And I just wrote a 90-page, all-in-rhyme fantasy book about a rhinoceros named Vantongerloo. And it's going to be it's a book called Vantongerloo's Dream, and I hope to have it out in the fall.
Oh, wow.
We look forward to that. I love children's books. I don't have any children. You do.
Yeah.
How many children do you have? I know about a daughter.
Yes, three. My daughter Daisy Claire is 17. My son Luke is 19. And just produced a track on Elton John's last record.
Wow.
Yeah. He's really
into it. Wow.
And my son Julian is at Columbia or Sony Records in New York. So I've got two kids in New York and one in LA. And They love music. I'm so glad.
How could they not? Yeah. Well, that's great. Did you name your son Julian after John Lennon's child? Or
I really didn't. Everybody thinks I did. I know. I just love that. It's such a, it rolls off your tongue so nicely.
Yeah.
It's a nice name for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, my only, getting back to baseball real quickly, you see my last name, my only baseball connection claim to fame is Willard Hershberger is the only major league player to have killed himself during the regular season.
That's so, right.
Mike Hershberger, who's not
Mike Hershberger, but
he's not a relative.
Now, I happen to interview the guy who, Harry Danning, who was the catcher for the New York Giants, who was behind the plate that day that Willard Hershberger had that bad day at the plate. And he talked to me on film. That was
Harry the Horse.
Yeah, Harry the Horse. And I made a little movie called The Last Giant, which was in the Baseball Hall of Fame, film festival. So he talked quite a bit. When he talked about Willard Hershberger, he was talking to me. He was 84 years old at the time, and he was so sad about it. He really, really was. It still affected him very, very much.
Yeah, it's an interesting story and not a whole lot out there about it, but I've been able to collect, we talk about collecting, but I've got a few of the articles, I've got a couple of his autographs, that's my little baseball collection.
Yes.
I'm not one of the Bash Brothers, full disclosure. I have no relatives who ever played baseball. So
it's all good.
Seth, this has been so much fun. We could talk to you for hours and hours, and maybe we'll have you back if you're up for it.
Of course.
You have so much you've done that
we haven't even scratched the surface of some of the things.
Yep, indeed.
You know, like indeed. Your documentary, for example. So we'll have you back someday if you're up for it.
Oh my God, I've enjoyed this so much, and I'm just honored to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we will do this again. Best of luck with Songs from the Green Couch.
Absolutely.
Everything else you got going on. And Seth, it was an absolute pleasure to talk with you tonight.
Thank you so much.
You have a great night, my friend. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you,
Seth. All right.
Well, there you go, David Bash. Episode number 56 of Material Issues with Seth Swirsky. Wow.
That was fun. I apologize for the distractions. First, having to get IPOCD materials into the manufacturer via email. That was one. And then my smoke alarm going off or carbon dioxide. Either way, I hope I'm not going to suffocate or have everything burn up. But it seems like it's all okay for the moment.
It's all right. I was just glad it wasn't your pacemaker.
Everyone, I do not have a pacemaker. I have stents, but no pacemaker. Thank
you. I was like, what is that beeping?
I couldn't even tell where it was from. I don't know if you saw me, but I'm like looking at the one in here. I'm thinking that's where it is. And no, it was the one in the record room.
Wow.
But I mean, there's no smoke or flames in there. So
yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes these things malfunction. They're not really all that well made, as I'm sure you know if you have them.
No, indeed.
So I'll have to get another one. But that's another problem with those things. The only way to turn them off is to deactivate them. So once you turn it off, you have to buy a new one. But, whatever. They have them on Amazon, folks. Anyway, this was fun. Seth is a great guest. Yeah. Obviously, he has been interviewed before. You know that by him saying, thank you, by him saying such to that effect. And also because his demeanor is, very, very pro, very laid back. He's a great guy. And I, for those of you who are still listening, I know there are people who disagree with his politics, and we're living in a world now where if you disagree with somebody's politics, you tend to have animosity towards them, which I think is totally unfair. I want to say something. I had to go to the cardiologist a few years ago because I was having chest pains, and I thought, I don't know, maybe another heart attack. God, I hope not. Well, it turned out to be anxiety, which it often is. But the first person to call me when I left the cardiologist's office was Seth, asking me how I was. I mean, it's just a small gesture, but I'll never forget that. People, you need to remember, even if you disagree with somebody's politics, even if you think their political stance is vile, evil, any of those things, just know that, behind all that could very well be a person who is very good to other people. And I don't agree with Seth's politics. He knows that. But I love him as a human being.
There you go. Yeah. So
he's always been extremely good to me and extremely good to other people that I know. So that's just my two cents.
Yeah. It's good two cents.
And I'll never stop listening to his music, no matter what. I mean, he could say everybody needs to buy a Donald Trump portrait and hang it in their house. I still listen to his music.
Well, it's what it's all about. It's what it's all about. It comes down to the music. Great episode. Great episode 56. I don't think we have anybody on tap for next Wednesday.
But I'm working on some people. One of them is a member of a band that I really, really love. In fact, some people may know that their Lone album is my second favorite album of all time. So I'm working on somebody in that band, and hopefully we'll get him. You and I were just discussing somebody else who we both know. I'm going to contact him and see if we can get him. He would be a great guest also. There'll be other guests. Thankfully, both Mark and I know enough people that we'll be able to get some good guests. And that's good to hear. We're unfortunately just in a world where everything is so polar that, you end up hating a person because you dislike their politics. It's just wrong. You know, people are multidimensional. You know, look beyond that. I don't care which side you're on, left, right, wherever you lie in the political spectrum. Look beyond what a person's politics is and get to know the whole person. Yeah. And don't assume that, oh, if their politics are a certain way, they're just completely evil. No, they're not. They may not be evil at all. Okay. So my advice. Keep that in mind. I think the people who are listening probably feel that way, but there may have been some people. Thank you, Tim. There may have been some people who didn't listen because of that. And you know, you just missed out hearing a great interview by a really good person. So just anyway, enough.
And as we say, you know, stay tuned here. If you haven't joined the Facebook group Material Issues, join it. So we'll drop some notes from time to time, letting you know who's coming up, or go over to materialissues.com on YouTube and subscribe. It'll tell you who's coming up and tell your friends all about it. We appreciate you checking out Material Issues. We love being here every week. This is a absolute blast for David and I. And
it really is. And we look forward to episode 57 next week. We'll keep you all posted.
Hard to believe. Have a great night, my friend. We'll talk to you real soon.
You too. Thanks, everyone, for checking us out. We'll see you next week.
All right, everybody. Good night.